Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Pod save the king.
So hello and welcome back to Pod Save the King. I'm your host Anne Gripper, and I'm delighted to welcome back to the show Ingrid Stewart, the editor-in-chief of Majesty magazine, hugely respected royal writer and biographer. I know Ingrid's been on the show chatting with Zoe Forsey in the past, but I'm delighted to have the opportunity to chat with you today, Ingrid. Welcome back.
Thank you, that's very kind.
It's great to have you with us. Your latest book, and you've been prolific, obviously, over the years writing about the royals, and I'm sure our listeners will have come across your books in the past, but your latest focuses on the relationship between Charles and his mother. My Mother and I is published by Simon & Schuster, and it's out now. I'm going to start off with a sort of a question/comment from a listener from Catherine Marchant Mills Davis. She said, "I love the picture for the cover. It shows the unity." So I wanted to ask you, so to start off by asking, how would you describe the relationship between Charles and his mother, and how did it evolve over time? Because I mean, that's clearly the focus of your latest work.
Well, I think when he was a very little boy, obviously it was wonderful, as it nearly always is with mothers and sons, mothers and daughters, and they were very close. But then, but he was 4 years old when she became queen. And she was 26. And she basically had motherhood taken away from her, because it was, we're talking about, Charles was born in 48. So 54, in 52, she became queen. And it was very, very much a man's world. I mean, the world was very different in 1952. And this was the world Charles was born into, which was one of great respect for the monarchy, surrounded by flunkies and people, people still walked out of the room backwards so that they didn't turn their back on the monarch. That's just a tiny detail, but it gives you an idea of how much more reverential. And the Queen hadn't expected her father to die. It was a shock. And so she really was unprepared. You can never be prepared for something like that, but she was relatively unprepared. So she said that I just did everything my father did. She even had the same people working for her. But what that meant was that she had no time for her children. She had Charles, age four, an 18-month-year-old Anne, and a husband who was in the Navy. So she was very reliant on staff around her to look after the children, and that meant the nannies. So Charles was brought up by nannies, and he did see his parents. Obviously, he saw them, briefly in the morning and briefly in the evening, and he saw them the summers at Balmoral. But in his mind, he was never hugged by his mother. Because he said that much later when he did an official biography with Jonathan Nimbleby, he said, "I was never hugged by my mother." And this really, hurt the Queen. This is much, much later. So they had, they had a very sort of a period where they just, they were obviously very nice to each other, but they really didn't connect in a way that they did later on.
Were they almost more, colleagues almost, rather than a mother-son relationship? She's preparing him for one day he will become king, but he's also her son. So you've got two conflicting roles there in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. And and also Charles was basically away at school then. So he went to prep school where his father had been Cheam, and then he went to a public school where his father had been Gordonston, and then he went to Trinity College, Cambridge, and in between he went to Australia. So he wasn't around that much, and I don't think I don't think the Queen really knew her son that well at that stage of his life.
Looking at that picture on the front of the cover, it does look like a very warm relationship. And in her later years, I mean, I think she probably must have certainly formally for her work relied on him a lot. Did that had that changed behind the scenes for them as well?
Yes, it had. I think it was probably really during the period he was married to Diana, he had a quite a difficult relationship with his mother, because she just when the marriage started going wrong, she just didn't understand, and he was very frustrated. But I think after the divorce, that they really became much, much closer. And I think that she was then also she realized what a sterling job her son had done with the Prince's Trust, and which is now the King's, now it's under the umbrella of the King's Foundation. But he was the first member of the royal family really to care about kids from inner cities and deprived areas, and he really did well with that, and she was very proud of him. And then she sort of realized that although she was brought up in this world where you don't show affection and you don't sort of hug each other, she actually said that she was very proud of him, and they got closer. I mean, it sounds a bit mad, but it really was like that. And people imagine that the royal family are together all the time, but they're not. They don't even see each other that much.
It's like, I guess it's like any of us. You grow up together. Although it sounds like I probably saw a lot more of my parents and maybe even my siblings than Charles did when he was growing up. But then you grow up, you move away, you've got your busy job, your own children, you have a busy life getting on with things and see each other at special occasions and when you can.
Yeah, exactly. But then they became much, much closer. And then I think the Queen actually, realized that, well, I think she realized from the beginning that Charles was very like her. Anne was very like her father, Prince Philip. And Charles was very like his mother, the Queen. He was shy, he was sensitive, he actually was quite nervous of meeting new people, all things which the Queen had to deal with, and had a great sense of humor, which of course we saw with the Queen, especially during her dotage, I would say, in her older years. We just saw that humor so much, and how funny she was, and how quick-witted she was. And then this relationship with Charles became very warm, and she was really proud of him.
A lot of people maybe think of him as a little bit, I don't know, grumpy, and there was all the stuff with the pens and everything when he was having to sign all of the documents, and they easily sort of knocked off balance, and maybe a little bit new age in some of his views with the plants and things. What I don't know, how would you describe him? And I enjoyed seeing some of the more wild stories as well that probably we don't necessarily think of.
Charles wasn't as, wasn't as dull as he was made out. He was a fun guy. He liked to party. He liked having fun, but he had a his serious side was the sort of side we saw more of him. And of course, he's renowned to have a bad temper, and he admits he has a bad temper, and he goes really, really angry, and then it's all over very quickly. So he doesn't sulk. And he can be very bad tempered, as we've seen. I mean, the pen incident, and a few others. But and obviously staff have seen him. But he's always afterwards always really sorry and didn't mean to throw the books or whatever he does. I mean, he does have a violent temper, but it's over very quickly, which is much better than sort of being sulky and making it last for days.
And you mentioned going to Highgrove for tea in the past, which I'm sure is something that all of us would be very delighted to do one day if we were given the opportunity. I mean, what was that like? What is Charles like as a host, I
Well,
guess?
a very good host, obviously. I mean, he's very, he's bought it. He's got perfect manners. They've all got perfect manners, those royal children, obviously, because they were brought up to have perfect manners. And Charles was absolutely charming. And I didn't really realize that I would be sitting there with him. I thought it might be a sort of a few select press, but it was just me, which was really nice. And we just talked about everything. And because my husband was at school with him at Gordonstoun, I brought that up again to try and get him to talk about it. And then we laughed about things like we were talking about drugs and William and Harry, but this was before that Harry got into trouble with drugs. And he said, I do worry a lot about my children and drugs. And He said the only drug I ever took was a cigarette and behind the chicken coops, he said. And it was just that kind of conversation. We laughed a lot. He was very good company.
I guess, parents' worries for their children are maybe different, but there are some similar themes, whatever your role in society, by the lines of things, if Charles was worried on that front. I mean, what were the Queen's worries for her son as he was a youngster, would you say?
I think she worried that he what didn't have that he wasn't actually strong enough in a way. I think she worried that he was more artistic and he loved reading poetry and Shakespeare's sonnets, but she saw that he could in his acting was the part of Charles that a lot of which we see now. I think when he was on stage doing school plays and things, he really came out of himself. And so it was always there, his ability to speak really well, which I think he is magnificent at now. He's like a trained actor, like a Shakespearean actor, the way he delivers his message. And I think that she just worried that some of his ideas might be too extreme. And then she realized that actually maybe they were, but she was wrong, and he was a really, he did have the makings of kingship.
One of the, I don't know, one of the extraordinary things, I guess, is to discover that your mum's made you the Prince of Wales by watching it on the TV.
I know, I mean, pretty difficult that. I mean, he's described that himself on several occasions, how he just, everyone turned and looked at him, and these were, young kids at prep school, and they were in the headmaster's study, and they were listening to the Queen, saying, I'm, in time I'm going to make my son the Prince of Wales, and he didn't really know anything about it.
And how did she, I mean, it sounds like she didn't give him very much warning on that bit, or not at all, but how did she try to prepare him for kingship? Was that always on the track, or did she not worry about it too much because she
No,
was too busy
she did
being
worry
queen?
about it, but she got him the very best tutors, the very best people she could to teach him, because she wasn't able to sit down and teach him herself because she didn't have the time. This is something she remedied with William, because when William went to school at Eton and the Queen was at Windsor, well, all William had to do was just go across the bridge from Eton to Windsor, and then he'd go and have tea with his grandmother. And she realized how very important that was. And her father done that for her. And she probably felt that she hadn't really given Charles enough of her own time on this matter, because she was so very young and so very busy herself when she became queen. And then she had the second family. And then Charles was away at school, so she missed that those sort of early years. So, like William was only at Eton, so which was very close, but Charles was up in northern Scotland. I mean, she did go and see him at Gordonstoun, and they did spend time together. But I always got the feeling they didn't spend as much time together as Charles would have liked.
And of course, the Queen travelled a huge amount when, in her sort of the early decades of her reign, and travel was not very fast comparatively back then. So she was away for huge amounts of time.
She was away. I mean, those royal tours in those days were really long and arduous, and it meant, being parted from your children or your teenagers or however old they were. So, I mean, I remember Princess Anne saying, in a way, we bought ourselves up. They were left to have quite a free rein. I mean, they had the discipline of the nannies and the tutors and the governesses, before Charles went to school, he had a wonderful governess called Miss Peebles, whom he adored. But later, they were really left much more to their own devices than probably William has ever been.
And I think our listeners are always a bit fascinated. It's probably partly due to the Finding Freedom phenomenon and how much involvement was there or not, to hear a bit more. So Karen Kerr is asking, how much access did you have to the royal family and their friends? So, what resources did you draw on, if you like, to build this picture of the Queen and her son?
I drew on resources of that I gathered over several years, and I decided that I would. I can't. I don't really like it when I read a royal source said, and or another royal source or a friend said, because I think we've got past that now. And obviously, you can't quote people if it's going to upset them, so you can't quote them at all. But I thought I'm either going to quote them or I'm and say who they are, or I'm not going to say anything about it. So I did quote people that had told me things, and I think that, and I put a lot of anecdotes in because people love anecdotes, and so do I. I love reading about anecdotes.
Which is your favorite?
Oh, in the book. Oh my goodness. I quite like the one about Gary Glitter, but I know he's a totally disgraced person. So it's a bit. But if you go back in time, Gary Glitter, this is before he was ousted as a paedophile, he was a huge, huge star, selling millions and millions of records. And people would go crazy screaming like they did for the Beatles. And one night, this is a story that Gary told. One night they were at a dinner party in a social, not a socialite, but a guy called Nigel Bogues, who was head of Cunard at the time. And they were at a dinner party at his gorgeous house. I think it was in Kensington. And Charles said to Gary Glitter, "What's it like being a pop star?" Which you can imagine him saying. And I don't know what Gary Glitter said, but anyhow, they had a laugh together. I think they were opposite each other at a dinner table. And in the end, they got up and started singing and dancing and singing a Ying Tong song, which you probably don't remember, but it was a big thing of the Goons. And Charles is a huge fan of the Goons. So they sang and danced this song together. And I love the idea of that. I mean, Charles, he knew how to have fun. He wasn't just a sort of stick in the mud.
I think it's that different generations appreciate the royals in different ways. So, to me, the Queen is a grandmother, and well, the late Queen is
Yes, you have to remember to say that, yeah.
the grandmother of the country, and Charles is sort of the, I don't know how to frame it, but he's less glamorous or sort of in the sh maybe not exactly in the shadows,
Well,
a bit more problematic.
I don't think he is necessarily a glamorous figure or has ever, well, I suppose he was when he was younger, but I think he's someone that has been through a hell of a lot, and it's amazing that he's come out sort of virtually unscathed. When you think of the scandals that have been around him and Camilla, and I think it is a really credit to him that people now respect him. I know not everybody does. But I think people do, and they see the good he's doing, and they forget about the scandals he's been involved with, or they put it aside because it doesn't really matter anymore. And you think, he really cares about this country. That's what I love about him. He really, really cares about what happens. And it's you don't feel any of our politicians care. You feel as though they're just, making their own nest. But you actually feel that King Charles cares, and he cares about the environment, and he cares what happens to our planet. He's the sort of Royal David Attenborough, I think.
We're recording this interview the last Monday in February, so the King is continuing his cancer treatment. Kate remains recuperating after her own surgery. Prince William's back at work, so it's been an unexpected start to the year for the royal family. They've had huge health issues to be dealing with, which essentially most of the time none of us ever expect, and then we have to deal with and get on with them. But how do you think Charles will be coping with his illness and sort of being action out of action while he is treated for it?
I think he's been very brave speaking out about his illness, because he's a very private person and nobody wants to talk about their private life, let alone any illnesses they might have. But I think he was so encouraged when he mentioned that he had a prostate problem, because so many people just thought, oh my gosh, I must do something about it. I must get mine checked. And those, so I think when he discovered, which must have been an awful shock because it certainly wasn't expected, that he had cancer, and what kind of cancer, we don't know. But we might know. I think he was very brave to speak out. And he also, it seems like a more modern thing to do. So that instead of being secretive about everything, the monarchy are trying to be more open. And this is certainly a way of opening things up.
Is that one of the major changes that you've seen since the reign of Queen Elizabeth II?
Yeah, I think the other major change is that Charles seems more accessible than his mother. But then she was a very elderly woman. And although he just seems, I love the way he reaches across the crowd and shakes hands. I mean, Prince Philip used to do that, but nobody really noticed so much. But I think Charles has this ability with people, and I think we just see a lot more of it, and the openness. And I think that is, I don't think somebody of the Queen's age could have changed, been like that. But certainly, as she got older, we did see her be much funnier. She was always funny, but she allowed us to see it.
And what do you think she would have made of her son's reign so far?
I think she'd be very proud of him. I mean, mothers are always proud of their sons, as long as they haven't done anything awful. And I think she would be very proud of him. I think she'd be very pleased to see that her judgment of Camilla was eventually right, because she felt that Camilla would be the one person that could really support him through what is essentially a very, very lonely and a pressurized job. Being monarch, being head of state, is lonely, pressurized, and there's no private life. But there is Camilla, just being so supportive, and she's won huge support as well from not everyone. Anyway, always remember when I say everyone loves her, they don't. But she has won a great deal of supporters that she didn't have before.
Probably certainly more than people might have imagined at various stages. I mean, you mentioned a bit earlier about Diana and the Queen not really knowing what to do with her and sort of the impact that had on the relationship with Charles. And I think to a certain extent, we've seen with the arrival of Meghan in the family how the choice of your partner, I mean, families all over the place will know this, the choice of a partner can have a big make a big change to relationships within a family. How did Diana and her relationship with Charles and Camilla and her relationship with Charles, how did those sort of phases of Charles's romantic life, I guess, affect his relationship with his mother and I guess his own character as well to a certain extent?
I don't think his mother knew ha had any idea how difficult Diana was, and that used to really frustrate Charles, because and also the Queen wasn't used to and never got used to moral confrontation, because if you're royal, there's always other people to do things like, I don't want to take that telephone call, or don't put them through, or there's always a way to get round avoiding people you really don't want to see or you don't want to talk to, and that can go into your romantic life as well. So they are not good at moral confrontation. When I say moral confrontation, they're not good at saying, well, actually, I never want to see you again, sort of thing, or get out of my sight, or they're not good at that kind of thing. And I think the Queen used to dread Diana coming to see her in her sitting room and cry and say, everybody hates me. And then the next day it would be a different story. And I think the Queen dreaded it because she didn't know how to deal with it. And that also upset her because she felt she should be dealing with it and she should be helping Diana, but she just didn't have the wherewithal to do it. She didn't know how to deal with it. And nobody did, actually, sad, no, nor did Charles.
For the Queen and her relationship with Camilla, I mean, the Queen being able to come out and say in her later years, that this is my hope that Camilla will be Queen Consort for Charles, that was a big step. Obviously, made massive headlines at the time and helped pave the way and smooth the path for what we see now. But had that been a long time in the
The
making?
Queen knew Camilla. Camilla's husband, Andrew Parker Bowles's father, was a great friend of the Queen Mother. So they were all sort of, you know, they all knew each other. They were all racing people. They were country people. They all knew each other. The Queen knew Camilla, but she couldn't condone the relationship between Charles and Camilla because Charles was a married man and he was the Prince of Wales. The Queen could not possibly have anything socially to do with Camilla as long as she was around her son. So she never did entertain her. But after the death of Diana and after that had, you know, kind of calmed down a bit, the Queen realised that, you know, Camilla was the one person who really could support Charles. And she saw that probably before, you know, other people in the royal family did.
You mentioned before that the royal family aren't traditionally very good at saying, this is no good, I'm having nothing more to do with this. That feels like it might have changed slightly, at least for sort of Harry's side of the family. There's been a bit more, I don't know, I guess extremes of emotions maybe, or defined lines and drawing lines in the sand and things. I mean, how do you think that sort of the evolution of Charles's relationship with his, even with his own mother, or his challenging relationships that he's dealt with in the past, has that steeled him or given him hope for how he deals with his son and then his two sons and their broken relationship?
I think Charles feels, I think he's just, well, he's probably at the moment, he's certainly not got time. He mustn't let it worry him. You know, stress is really bad for any kind of cancer, but I'm sure it has given him a lot of stress. But if there's nothing he can do about it, there's no point worrying about it at this moment. There will be a moment, and Harry is always going to be a thorn, a sort of proverbial thorn in the side, because Charles is always going to worry about what he's going to do next, what he's going to say, and also remember that he is his son and he obviously wants to see him, and I'm sure he'd like to see his grandchildren. But I think he's being patient because that's all he can be, and their lives are so busy that I don't think there's a great deal of time to dwell on it. And if you did dwell on it, what could you do anyway? I mean, it's probably a problem a lot of families face with, and if there's nothing they can do, there's nothing they can do. But he's not going to alienate Harry. If Harry wants to alienate himself, there's not very much Charles can do. But he knows that Harry won't do that because Harry needs the glow of Charles's kingship to shine on him too.
And Teresa Tui asks whether there's anyone who you think could be a broker to a peace agreement between the brothers, like who would be, you know, is there a person who might in future, when there is a moment, be the key negotiator or go-between? Or
I think there's only one person it could possibly be, and that is Kate, the Princess of Wales. She's the only person that could do it, and obviously she's probably not of a mind to do it right at the moment.
We were talking earlier as well about, you know, the Queen, she went very much duty first, whereas we've seen in the last few months, you know, William has been very much family first, almost sort of the total opposite of the scale. We're taking an extended period of time, even while, you know, his dad was out of the picture, but William was like, no, I need to be with my wife and looking after the children as well. How do you see that, how that has evolved and how the way the royal family works and I guess how they care about family differently maybe now compared to how they used to?
Well, I think I'm absolutely certain that King Charles would have said to William, you know, please, please, please put your family first while you're able to, because you know, when you are monarch and head of state, all being well, you're not going to be able to do that. You are certainly not going to be able to do that then, so do it now. And he's always said that. That's why he was quite happy for William to delay doing royal duty, you know, taking on all these royal engagements, because they are so time-consuming. So William was able to have a career, you know, in the air ambulance and enjoy his family. And that's what his father wanted him to do. So, I mean, I know that the number of, you know, royal people, if you like, peoples, is far, far less now, but they're managing, and if they can't do everything, they can't do everything. He always talked about a scaled down royal family. Charles thought there were just too many royals doing too many things and being too much of a burden on the public purse. He always felt that.
It probably maybe answers Amy Downer's question of, is there any chance of Beatrice being promoted to support the royal family more? Or I guess, any of that younger generation, because I think it has brought home really, Charles being unwell, that in that the younger generation is very minimal, because it's now essentially William and Kate, and their children are very young still.
Yes, I think that I don't think Beatrice will be. I think she'd be brilliant, but I don't think she'll be brought back into the role. Well, into the royal fold. I just don't think she will. I think there's obviously the problem with Andrew, which is a separate problem altogether. But there's just, I think it's better just left the way. I think I am guessing, obviously, but I think Charles would feel it's just better left the way it is at this moment in time. And I don't think Beatrice will step up. I mean, she would be great, but I think it's then suddenly you've got a smaller monarchy and then you've got a bigger monarchy again. I think it's better left for the moment the way it is.
Couple more questions from listeners before we finish. History Hardy asks, did Charles get along with Angela Kelly? What did he make of her and her relationship with the Queen?
Well, I'd love to ask him that, but I'm only assuming at that. I mean, Angela, he realized that Angela Kelly was, had been amazing and deeply loyal to his mother, but he didn't like the way she was a self-promoter. He didn't like that, and he didn't approve of the way that a friend of hers took some amazing pictures of the Queen, such as slightly posing in a model-like pose with her hands in a pocket, which were gorgeous. But Charles found them. He didn't think it was right that she should do that. And he was irritated by it. Doesn't mean he disliked Angela Kelly at all. It's just that he was irritated by some of the things that she did.
And Iris Mawson asks, did the late Queen ever express maternal guilt about her work coming before parenting?
Yes, she did. I think she did. And she did. There was one occasion when she said to her mother, the Queen Mother, I think they were all at Sandringham, and the Queen Mother was playing bridge, paying patience, I think. And the Queen was just sort of, this was probably just after the Annus Horribilis or around that time. And the Queen said, where have I gone wrong? Where have I gone wrong? How come that, three out of the four of my children's marriages have gone wrong? And what am I to do? Where have I gone wrong? And the Queen Mother looked at her and said, don't worry, darling. It's a different generation. Let them get on with it. She did worry, of course she worried. But if she couldn't do anything about it, there was nothing, she wasn't going to waste her energies because she didn't have time to waste her energies. You and I can waste our energies lying awake at night and worrying. I'm sure she did too. But if there's nothing she could do about it, there was nothing she could do about it.
How fundamental do you think the late Queen and Charles's relationship was in shaping him as a, I guess, as a man, as a king, and as a father, either through, positive impact or him reacting against it?
Well, I certainly think as a father, he determined he was going to see more of his children and be closer to his children than his life. But of course, it's a different era that he was brought up in the 50s, and William and Harry were brought up in the 80s, and it was very, very different. And I think that his mother—he had enormous respect for the Queen, enormous respect—and I think that she was a guide for him. And I think, her devotion to duty was an example to everyone in the royal family.
So now it's time for our question of the week for listeners. We just want to know this week what your favourite family relationship is among the royals. We're not talking about romantic relationships here, we're talking about blood relations. So you can't just say William and Kate or Harry and Meghan or any other relationship like that. It's someone who is, they didn't have any choice about it. They're born and related to them, and that is how it is, not their partner. Which relationship, what relationship do you fancy looking at next, Ingrid? Which and what intrigues you?
I don't know. I've always been intrigued by the royal children, but I've written a book about royal children. I would love to explore a sort of more behind the scenes, the people that make the functions of the monarchy work, not the household, but more the sort of, I'd love to talk to all the nannies, for instance, but of course they never would in a million years. And also a lot of them aren't around anymore. But I'd love to get that. That's what I would really like to do, but I can't.
Wow, that would be brilliant if you found a way. We would love to have you on to talk about
Just to
that.
hear their stories and the, you know, all those wonderful little vignettes about the children.
Yeah, the children probably wouldn't thank them for it, I could
No,
imagine.
it wouldn't happen because you know, one thing is that they would be totally destroyed. And as I said, most of them aren't around anymore anyway.
Ingrid, it has been an absolute joy to chat with you about Charles and the late Queen and various other royals and their relationships along the way. And do let us know next time your whatever your next book is out. And we'd love to have you back on to chat more about the royals.
God save the king!